Okay, so thank you very much. So this is a project that I worked on, a consulting project that I worked on with the Arizona State Retirement System with Eric Glass, and he's here over in the back there. And so basically, so a little background on the Arizona State Retirement System. They're a pension fund managing around approximately $33 billion assets under management. They have an investment staff of 10 people with 3 to 4 focused on the equity side of things. And so the scope of the project encompassed basically three things. And so the first one was to research a set of equity factors. And then from there, it was reviewing index providers that provide indexes for these factors as that are marketed as a cost-efficient way for investors to harvest these factor returns. And part of the decision was made to look at the factor indexes because this is a relatively small team with limited resources. So there wasn't a lot of desire to sort of recreate the wheel and build out factor single factor strategies on their own. And so then the final part of that was constructing a portfolio of these single factor indexes into a multi-factor portfolio. And we were constrained to domestic equity, large and mid-cap stocks. So the term zoo of factors has been coined in recent terms, really just to explain the plethora of new factors that have come out in top-tier journals in the last few years. And so just between 2010 and 2012, over 59 new factors were, you know, discovered and published. So in an effort to navigate through this factor zoo, we set some criteria based on the prevailing academic and practitioner research. So that would help us kind of whittle down to the set of factors that really, you know, were robust and ideally also had out-of-sample validation since factor discovery, and then also validated their performance out-of-sample in terms of different asset classes across different regions geographically. So not just factors that just worked in the U.S., ones that also worked abroad in a different asset classes, so equities, commodities, and interest rates even. And so while not everyone agrees on these are the individual factors that will work, they have worked in the past, they will work going forward, kind of the general consensus is that these factors here mentioned on the bottom of the slide, this is kind of the general consensus among the academics and practitioners that these are the valid factors. So this is kind of where we focused our research going forward. And so now that we've identified these factors, the next thing is, so we've identified index providers that have these products for these factors. And so the important question is, does it really matter which index provider we choose? You know, there are only so many ways to construct a momentum factor. Does it matter? Are they all the same? And so if you don't like spoilers, don't pay attention to the next couple slides. So, and if they were all the same, I probably wouldn't be up here talking for another 20 minutes. So the punchline is that they are not the same. There are differences qualitatively as well as quantitatively. And so while a lot of the factor providers have similar definitions of factors where they follow, you know, the academic research to define these factors, they are different across the providers. And I really think that this is a way that their attempt to add value and separate themselves from the competition where their research team thinks that there is value. And there's also going to be a difference in the universe that we're you know, picking these stocks from, where we have, you know, for example, S&P 500, MSCI, USA, large and mid, and the Russell 1000. So there are some differences in universe of the stocks that we can select and what our set is. You know, quantitatively, we can look at some simple things, just risk and return characteristics. And the other really big caveat is that a lot of this data is less than a few years of out-of-sample performance since the Factor product was actually launched. So we always have to keep that in the back of our mind when we're doing this analysis, that a lot of this is in-sample data. So I'm just going to kind of go relatively quickly through these next few next set of slides. But so what we're looking at here is in the top panel, this is cumulative return. The middle panel is just daily return. And then the bottom panel here is drawdowns. And I have anonymized the data because this is not a sales pitch of saying any single factor provider is better than the other. It's just to show that there are differences and we can quantify those differences. So here with the size factor, there's two different flavors of size, equal weight and actually like inverse cap weighted. So some of these are just equal weighting the portfolios or equal weighting the stocks, and others are actually doing an inverse market capitalization. But the end result is the same, where the smaller cap stocks are going to have a higher weight relative to the passive benchmark, and then vice versa for the larger capitalization within a certain category. And so we can see that there is some spread between the different single factor indexes. They do beat the S&P 500 in just in terms of total cumulative return. Their drawdowns are pretty similar. And then here, this is a bar chart of annual performance relative to the S&P 500 that we use as a benchmark. And so here we can see that there are some years where there's good performance, are the years where there's some underperformance, but we can really see the cyclical nature of the size factor, where sometimes it's going to outperform, other times it isn't. So now we get into value. Again, we see a spread between the different single factor indexes, and we see a wider spread here than we do in the size factor. And then one thing to point out too is these drawdowns are pretty steep. Whereas the S&P 500 had a drawdown of approximately 50%, some of these surpassed the 60% drawdown. So in the 2008-2009 financial crisis, some of these value factor indexes really got hammered. Kind of similar story to size. Some years of outperformance, other years of underperformance, kind of mixed the last few years. And then here, if we actually look at the just annualized return, standard deviation, and Sharpe ratio, we see that there are actually a handful of these factor indexes that underperform the S&P 500 here, and others that do. And then here, looking at momentum, there's you can see that there's two up here that have pretty similar returns. There's a much smaller spread between two of these. And then the black is the S&P 500, and then this red and blue down here, we can see that those actually have really similar returns to the S&P 500 and actually don't even outperform them, it turns out. So there is a difference in spread here between some of those. Again, we see cyclical nature of the factor returns here. So now we get into volatility. And volatility, the one thing that jumps out for me here, you can kind of see this teal line here. It has very different return characteristics than any of the other ones. And so it turns out that that is marketed as a volatility index, but it really uses a beta, yield, and liquidity weighting. So this is really not a single factor index. This is more of a multi-factor index. And oh, by the way, its live date is 2014. So where it really excels is it doesn't have nearly as bad of a drawdown as the other indexes. So maybe they are onto something, but I'm kind of skeptical that that's a backtest overfit, where they just found a set of rules and parameters where they avoided the deeper drawdown relative to these other strategies. So that's something to be very aware of too, because it's out of sample performance is only, you know, here and over to the right. And then as far as for the other ones, there's two different flavors of volatility factor indexes. Minimum volatility, which is based on an optimization to find the minimum variance portfolio. And then the other one is just a simple annualized standard deviation, selecting stocks and ranking them based on just that simple metric. So again, like other ones, we see cyclical nature of returns here. The the multi-factor volatility index that I'll call it, you can see here it really jumps out as having very different returns to the other ones, but I'm skeptical on how real this actually is. Next we get to quality. Again here we see, you know, a spread between these different indexes. One thing to be aware of is that these top two here that have the best total cumulative return here, these are actually from the same index provider, and they're just using different quality metrics. So they have two quality metrics, and they're calling those separate indexes, where as several of the other providers use an aggregate measure where they're looking at three or four different quality metrics and averaging those to come up to score and rank their stocks. Another thing here is we see that this, you know, compared to the other bar graphs that we were looking at, there's a much longer string of outperformance of, you know, 4 to 8% per year here up through 2011. And then 2012 through 2016, it's kind of mixed. But one thing to be aware of is that a lot of these, the quality indexes specifically, they were not live until 2015 or so. It's debatable on when you could say that the quality factor was discovered, but the most prominent paper on the quality factor was the Fahm and French five-factor paper, which I believe came out in 2014. So we really have very few years of out-of-sample post-factor discovery returns for other researchers to validate. And in actuality, there have been several other papers come out that say that they do not find that this is a statistically robust factor outside of US data. So the jury's still kind of out on that. And then we get to yield. So the last one that we looked at was yield. Again, there's quite a big spread between the different providers, even though they're using similar rules for defining yield. But one thing to point out too is that the worst case drawdown one here, that has a drawdown of 70%. So that's pretty painful. So you need to decide, what types of risk and return characteristics you're comfortable with for including factors in your multi-factor portfolio. And if you actually dig into the factor definitions and rules to create these, the top, the blue line and the other kind of teal line, these are highly concentrated stocks where they're only choosing either 40 to 50 or 80 assets out of the universe of assets. So we have a lot of concentration here for these high yield stocks. Okay, so now that we've gone through that practice and we've identified it, that there is a difference between these single factor indexes, the next question is, how do we construct a portfolio of these single factor indexes or single factor strategies? And really what we have here is a portfolio optimization problem. And a lot of these index providers do offer multi-factor indexes, but they have very different construction rules. Some do a bottom-up selection process where they're really stock-picking certain stocks that have higher exposures to the factors that they're targeting. And others use a top-down approach where they use the single-factor indexes or strategies as building blocks to form a portfolio from a top-down perspective. And also, it's very difficult comparing one multi-factor index to another because a lot of these also target different factors. We might have one multi-factor index which is looking at momentum, volatility, and size, and another is looking at momentum, size, yield, and value, or so on and so forth. So we have to be really careful about how we're comparing these and looking at the different risk and return characteristics based on our factor exposures. And so I was interested in can we beat these multi-factor indexes that are provided by these index providers? And so I wanted to look at a portfolio optimization approach where we can actually specify a set of constraints and objectives and use more of the information to form a portfolio. Because in theory, we should be able to smooth out some of the cyclical nature of the individual single-factor indexes. And so in order to do this, I'm going to use portfolio analytics to run my optimizations. And so here we see on this slide, the code here, all this is doing is specifying a portfolio, and we're adding two constraints. We're adding a constraint such that the weights need to sum to one, approximately one. Here I relax them a little bit, just so that the optimizer and for random portfolios, when we're generating the weights, we get approximately one, because it's pretty hard to generate, you know, let's say 10,000 random portfolios that equal exactly one in terms of, you know, right on the dot of one. So we relax them a little bit so that we're able to generate them. And then box constraints, 15% and 40%. Then I generate the random portfolios. And then here, I'm specifying different objectives that I'm going to test. And so I'm actually going to set up five different portfolio specifications with five different objectives. And so the first one here is just our really simple minimum standard deviation portfolio, where we're trying to minimize risk. And so our definition of risk here is going to be standard deviation. In the next one, our definition of risk is expected shortfall. And so this is actually modified expected shortfall, and we're using the 95% P there. And then here, I'm also going to test the equal risk contribution portfolios, where I want to minimize concentration or contribution to risk of each individual factor here. So I'm adding this risk budget objective here. And the key thing to note is that in a lot of these other ones here, I'm just saying add this objective to the port.spec object. But here I'm saying add it to the port.min.sd portfolio specification, and here the port.min.es. And so one of the key features of portfolio analytics is that it handles multi-objective problems very well. So what we're saying here is that I want the optimizer to give me the minimum concentration risk or equal risk portfolio with the minimum standard deviation for portfolio volatility, because there could be several portfolios that satisfy the minimum risk or equal risk concentration. So I also want to add that other objective on there too, so that I am also trying to minimize portfolio volatility. And then the last objective that we're trying is the constant relative risk aversion with a lambda of 5. And here is what the constant relative risk aversion is. It's based on the fourth order expansion of the Martellini and Zeman and the Bout, Liu, and Peters paper. And what you can do to get some intuition on how this objective function works or utility function works is that we can look at the signs of the different terms. So the M2 is the second moment, M3 is the third moment, M4 is the fourth moment, and it's negative, positive, negative. So that's saying I'm penalizing the second moment, I'm rewarding positive third moment, so I'm rewarding positive skew, right? I want my portfolio returns with positive skew, and then I'm penalizing kurtosis there in the third term, and I'm ignoring the expected returns vector of the first moment. I'm just saying I don't even want to try to estimate expected returns. Another key feature of portfolio analytics is that an objective function is any valid R function. So all I have to do is just define an objective function that I want to hand to the optimizer and say, here's my objective, now go do your thing and find me the thing that minimizes or maximizes it. So here's how I run the optimization. I'm just showing one snippet here to run the minimum standard deviation portfolio. To run it for the other ones, you would just replace port.min.sd with the other ones, specifying some rebalancing parameters. So I'm running the optimization using the random portfolios optimizer. I'm getting the weights and calculating the returns. And so then here in this next chart, I'm looking at the optimal weights that the optimizer gave me at each rebalancing period. And the black here on the bottom is our low volatility factor. And so it's no surprise that our minimum standard deviation portfolio wants more of the low volatility factor. And it's bumping up against its 40% constraint. And then you can see how the optimizer allocated between the its weights between the other factor indexes. Here's how it looks in terms of the performance. The black line is the S&P 500 on the bottom there. And then in the light gray behind it, that's the individual single factor indexes. And the optimized portfolios are grouped very tightly by this red line here, so that you can see that there's a very small spread of our optimized portfolios. 1 minute. Oh man, I got 10, 9 more slides. Okay, real quickly, I didn't show any of the optimizations of the other six factor, but I wanted to compare the six factor and the four factor. We can see that this is ranked in terms of annualized standard deviation. And so all the six factor portfolios beat the four factor portfolios. But one thing to be aware of is that if you have any doubts of the validity of the quality factor here is the kind of like pinkish and turquoise color here. And then the black at the bottom is our low volatility. And so our six factor portfolio is really heavily allocated in the low volatility factor and the quality factors. And so we need to think hard if we're concerned about the validity of the quality factor on whether or not, you know, we either need to just get those out of our portfolio or constrain them to smaller weights. And then last thing I'm going to finish up real quick is doing portfolio simulation using the random portfolios logic to simulate no-skill managers across time in terms of if we didn't have any view on different objectives or preferences to minimum standard deviation or minimum expected shortfall portfolios, how would we do relative to other people that are just randomly grabbing weights? And a key difference between doing the simulation with random portfolios and other simulations like Monte Carlo or bootstrap methods is that, you know, number one, with bootstraps, you are messing with the returns and you're not necessarily guaranteed to get a feasible portfolio. And when I'm saying feasible, I mean feasible in terms of our weight constraints. So there's no guarantee that we actually are going to get a feasible portfolio. Monte Carlo, we have to specify a model for the data generating process. And again, it's the same thing, may or may not be feasible portfolio. So if we want to look at our actual outcome, skipping through these. So here's our feasible portfolio in terms of cumulative return and drawdown on the y-axis, and on the x-axis we get time, so we can see how these random managers, zero-skill managers, would have done through time. Key thing here is we can see the drawdowns. The constraints really don't matter. We're still going to have a pretty steep drawdown during the global financial crisis. This is an important slide. This is looking at the distribution of standard deviation of all of my random managers, no-skill managers of my random portfolio, so I can see where is my minimum standard deviation portfolio in this distribution. Am I actually adding value by having this as an objective? And you can see our portfolio is way over here on the left, and it is statistically significant, so we can, you know, draw some inferences there. We can look at bootstrap p-values to determine whether or not it's significant. Skipping through those. So in conclusion, you have the tools available for you. All of this stuff was done with open source R, just using portfolio analytics and performance analytics and XTS mainly. So you have these tools available to apply quantitative rigor in making decisions on how to allocate or build a factor portfolio. So, you know, do your due diligence, and thank you. I hope that was useful. I'll be around if you have questions later. Oh, 40 slides.